Good afternoon. I'm Billy. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is January the 5th, 1990. My home group is the Tell It Like It Is group in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. I'll put a little caveat on how I introduced myself. I said my name is Billy not because I'm ashamed for you to know my last name, not because I'm ashamed of being an alcoholic, but because of our great 12 traditions. I'm being recorded today. And the group conscience of Alcoholics Anonymous says that regardless of Billy's ego, regardless if he wants to be like other speakers in the past before there was an internet and you could say your last name, that if you're being recorded, you hold back your last name. And I do that out of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous because Alcoholics Anonymous is more important than I am. I want to thank the committee for asking me to be here today. I was joking around before. It's good to see my friend Chris. We are just getting older, apparently. It seems that we are still alive, but getting older. Last weekend I was roughing it on a golf course in the Dominican Republic, and I was with someone else who I've known for a long time in sobriety. And, you know, as we were approaching this one hole towards the water, you know, we joked around with each other, you know, like, God, sobriety sucks, you know? Sobriety is really horrible. And it's easy to think about those times, right? You're on a golf course, looking at the ocean, golf course that's been on my list for a lot of years to play. But then there's the other side of sobriety in life. There's relatives dying, people I know in AA dying, divorce, the IRS, work, whole bunch of other things. In Bill's story, there's a line in the beginning, in the beginning of the book, but around page 7 or 8 of his story, you know, and it says, only through work and self-sacrifice can you survive the certain trials and pitfalls ahead. Now, that's good news and bad news, actually. The bad news for me is that, you know, I came to AA for the first time when I was 14 years old. I got sober when I was 23. I can assure you that work and self-sacrifice were not like my code of honor when I came here. If anything, it was opposite. Work and self-sacrifice sounds hard. Sounds like doing what the world expects you to do. But it says that's the only way. And it doesn't say only through work and self-sacrifice can the 50% of us that have a few rough times survive. It says the certain trials and low spots ahead. Bill tells us that sobriety is not a yellow brick road. It's not a basket of chocolate. It's not a flower delivery. It's life. Life is sometimes great, and sometimes it feels like, you know, there's somebody throwing a 90-mile-an-hour fastball right towards your helmet. That's what life is. But the opportunity that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me is to actually live life, to actually be here and do my best at living life. Because the other line that I think, there's a lot of paradoxes in AA. There's so many, you could do probably a week workshop on them. But, you know, if you go a few chapters in, I'll just skip ahead before I get to my story. You know, if you go on a cruise, or if you meet somebody at work, or you're somewhere in the grocery store, and someone uses kind of our code language, you know the code language that we can use. You know, it's very common for someone to say to somebody, are you a friend of Bill's? Now that's nice and it sounds good, and I get that Bill was one of the co-founders. But for me, the more important question is, are you a friend of Fred or Jim's? Because if you don't have an intimate relationship with Fred and Jim in the chapter more about alcoholism, it's hard for me. For me, I could not understand alcoholism or sobriety without understanding that chapter, especially the line, because here we have someone in the beginning, one of the co-founders, who says, only through work and self-sacrifice can you survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. So he says, life's going to be hard. Life's going to be rough. But then, a couple of chapters later, there's this guy having the greatest day of his life. The IRS hasn't called. He didn't get divorce papers. He's actually on a business trip for apparently a job that he loves. He's actually walking across a hotel lobby to go to dinner. He's minding his own business, which is pretty much the story of my whole fourth step, if you asked me, without any input from another, just minding my own business. And here this guy is minding his own business, and as the book says, at the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon, the thought comes to his mind that maybe he should have a drink. Just one. I was one time at a CPC presentation, and for anyone that's new to service, whatever that means, cooperating with the professional community, and, you know, someone was really going on a tangent about triggers. And I did all I could to sit on my hands and shut my mouth and, you know, because when I hear that word, or like when I hear that, like, maybe there's a trigger list, like we can hand it out to people. As long as you don't do these things, you will be perfectly fine. However, having a perfect day with not a cloud on the horizon is not on that list. Like, shouldn't we put that on that list? Shouldn't we put on the trigger list, whatever you do, do not have a perfect day with not a cloud on the horizon? Because in Alcoholics Anonymous and in today's recovery world, sometimes we like to send the message that some external force or condition is responsible for the internal condition that I suffer from. And, you know, I obviously, you don't need to be a language expert to know I'm not from Georgia. You know, I am it's funny. In most years, as a rabid sports fan, the Yankees carry me through being a long-suffering Jets fan, right? Most years, I am, the Jets are an every Sunday trigger, if you want to use that language, right? This week, however, the Yankees are killing me. But the Jets have won a couple of games in a row, which for us is like winning the Super Bowl. But I grew up Irish Catholic in New York City, and that does not make me an alcoholic. The Irish did not make me or any of their descendants alcoholic. They do say in the Bronx that maybe it makes you a little bit more thirsty and a little bit more guilty, but it does not make you a real alcoholic, as described in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I come from two parents who did the best they could with what they had, which wasn't a lot. And when I say wasn't a lot, not a lot materially, not a lot spiritually, probably I would say zero, but in the negative, in the emotions department, there was no hugging, no feelings, no anything like that. But they did the best they could. I have 42 first cousins. That's not a lot where I come from. My dad has 7 siblings. My mom has 9. It's like 4.2 kids per set of aunts and uncles. My dad was a deep cover narcotics agent. My mom, for a while, was a stay-at-home housewife and then a secretary for the local state hospital. And, you know, we moved from New York City out to Long Island. That was kind of the pilgrimage at that time. You know, it was basically New York City, but 50 miles away. Same thing, same people, same jobs. Everybody's dad was a cop or a fireman or a train operator or a subway operator or a union electrician or a pipe fitter or an iron worker. Same mentality, everything, same rules. No secrets inside the house, go outside the house ever. If you move outside of the house, you are not privy to the secrets inside of the house anymore. You don't talk about to anybody anything that you witness inside the house. You know, because I'm not arrogant enough. I was at one point to probably say some stupid things. And, you know, I try not to do that anymore. I actually, people have these nice fancy bracelets with lots of spiritual messages on them. Mine says DBAD. It stands for don't be A, and I don't need to finish the last word, right? That is my gentle reminder every morning as I face the work world and go out to the world. You know, ease up. Try to be a decent person. Try to realize that you have lots of character defects and shortcomings, and it's only by the grace of God that you have a chance to survive today. But I'm not foolish enough to say that growing up in that house, I didn't learn some really bad lessons. They didn't make me alcoholic, but I learned some horrible lessons about living in the world, living with other people, relationships, friendships, work. Not to mention, and believe me, I honor the 10th tradition. And I'm probably on tape somewhere where I am a little upset lately about the political agenda that has entered Alcoholics Anonymous. And I mean from both sides. I'm not pointing fingers. The right wing and the progressive left, they need to learn how to shut their mouth before they come into Alcoholics Anonymous meetings or behind podiums or anything else to do with AA. We don't have opinions on outside issues on none of them. But that's not where I come from. Where I come from, I was delivered to Alcoholics Anonymous, a racist, an anti-Semite, homophobic. Basically, the rule where I grew up was, you have to be Irish or Italian Catholic to be in our backyard, or there is one important exception. If you have a law enforcement or fire department badge in your pocket, then you are grandfathered in and you are part of the club. But that's it. That is the community that we live in. And, you know, drinking is what my family does. Some of them successfully, apparently. Not me, obviously. Not if I'm here at 4 o'clock and I got up at 6:30 to fly here. Obviously not successful for me. But alcohol was around everything I saw growing up. Everything. I have a very abnormal reaction to alcohol and a very abnormal relationship with alcohol. Some people might not have that story, but that's my story. I'm not proud or bragging to admit this because it's really kind of ridiculous. But I was 40 years old and 17 years sober before I really realized that the rest of the world thinks drinking a six-pack in one night is excessive. Like, I was 40 years old. I was already in AA, almost two decades, 17 years. And the reason I tell you that is I remember being 17 years old. And at that time, in order to stay in school, I had to see the school psychologist once a week. That was a requirement. Every bad kid in school had to see Dr. Pavi once a week. And I remember one time feeling like I was being such a good guy when I looked right at him one of those weeks and I said, you know what, Dr. Pavi? This Friday and Saturday night, I'm only going to have a six-pack. I thought like I was really overextending my kindness, like, you know what, I'm really going to be a decent guy this weekend and just have a six-pack. Mind you, 23 years later, I'm 40 years old, and I realize most people have never had a six-pack in one night. Most people think drinking six beers in one night is completely off the deep end. But I have this twisted, twisted relationship with alcohol. Now, if you're new, I want to let you know before I tell you a little bit more of my story that the outside world does not understand our disease. I could probably go a lot further and say there's a good part of the inside world that doesn't understand our disease. You know, there are people who come from behind this podium and want to say that if you're an alcoholic, you're a drug addict, you're a sex addict, you're a food addict, you're a gambling addict, whatever. That's complete nonsense. That goes against the primary purpose and the traditions of almost every other fellowship. You might be all those things, but just because you're one doesn't mean you're the other. I'm an alcoholic first and foremost because I have a physical allergy to alcohol. I know now that I'm not a trustee or a delegate or anything anymore, I could open up one of those stands to sell stuff at the international convention if I wanted in 3 years. For the past 15, I've been yelling about the people that sell stuff. But now I could be one of those people who sell things. And if you know, there is a saying in AA, once a pickle, never a cucumber. That's not my story. My story is never a cucumber. Never. I am the type of alcoholic described in the doctor's opinion. I have never, ever, ever had the ability to drink and not have my body want to keep drinking. If you're new, I just want to warn you that the outside world doesn't understand this. Maybe the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon family groups and Alateen members there do, but most people do not. I always have to apologize. I've learned to do this ahead of when I start speaking. So if you're an Al-Anon, I love Al-Anon. I might say some bad things about it. But if you're a chronic teenage alcoholic and your mother goes to Al-Anon, it's like your life blowing up in one instant second. You know, there are a lot of people in AA who say that there's nothing worse than a belly full of booze and a head full of AA. That's not my story. My story is there's nothing worse than my belly full of booze and my mother's head full of Al-Anon. That is my story. That is a much, much worse combination when you are a chronic teenage alcoholic. But people don't understand our illness. And you know, I heard this speaker one time, a long time ago, and he told this story, and I said, you know, that story is outlandish. I'll bet you he made it up. There is no way that that's true. Absolutely no way. And so what happens? I get sober. I go back to school. I get a career in an industry that I love, that still today I'm an executive in that industry. I've traveled around the world and around the country for the last 20 years. I've gone out to dinners all over the world. And some people I get to know pretty well, and every once in a while I will tell one of them I'm an alcoholic. Sometimes I'll tell them I'm an AA, depending on the situation. So if you're new, I just want to explain that first. There's a big difference between people knowing you don't drink and knowing why. Everybody knows I don't drink if I go out to dinner with you. But not everybody gets to know why. And that's something that should be between you and your sponsor. But I will tell you what happens. And it kills me because I wanted this speaker in my head to be making up the story because I accused him of making up the story. But I'm going to show you my experience 100% of the time. Not 99, not 99.5, 100%. If I am at dinner in a setting with people I know professionally and they only know me in the professional world and I tell them that I went to my first AA meeting at age 14 because a judge sent me to AA, I almost now want to jump across the table and I want to put my hand over their mouth before the words come out, because they can't help themselves. They have to say, God, you must have had a rough childhood. They just can't help themselves. They have to immediately give me a reason outside of me to blame my alcoholism on. It's incredible. Now, why is the physical allergy so important? Because you know what else I've learned going to dinner for work for 20 years? There's a lot of people in the world allergic to shellfish. I don't know if you know that. I found that out by going out to dinner with people at work. And you know how many times I've been at a table where somebody has said to the waiter or waitress, I just want you to know I'm allergic to shellfish. Do you know that 100% of the time, 100, nobody has opened up their mouth and said, oh, you must have really had a rough childhood. Nobody. Everybody at that table accepts that they have a medical scientific allergy to shellfish. They don't say things. And as the dinner conversation goes later, after I have let people know that I'm an alcoholic and that I came in when I was 14, there's a different dinner conversation than there is for the person who's allergic to shellfish. The person allergic to shellfish, 10 minutes later in dinner, nobody says, "You sure you don't want to try one?" Nobody says that, ever. 20 minutes later, the person allergic to shellfish, nobody says, "Hey, when's the last time you had an allergic reaction?" Nobody says that either. Then, like a half hour later, nobody says, "Is it a particular kind of shellfish? Or is it everyone just accepts?" It's like getting on a plane. I fly 3 or 4 days a week. I would say probably 3 or 4 times a month, I will be on a plane where the flight attendant will pick up that phone and will make an announcement to the aircraft. "I just want to let everyone know that there is one person on this plane with a peanut allergy. We will not be serving peanuts of any kind." Everybody on the plane just accepts, "We're not eating peanuts. This person's allergic." Now let me take you to the dinner where I've just told people that a judge sent me to AA at age 14. "You mean you haven't had one? Like, not one? Or could you have one now? Was it beer? Was it..." Like, they're like me at 17 years old. At 17 years old, without the aid of the big book, I knew that my first problem was the first shot after the eighth beer. I knew that. I knew as a senior in high school that if I could just not do shots, I would be fine. And you know, in AA today, we take so much time talking about the ism and the spiritual malady and all this other stuff, and we downplay the first requirement to be an alcoholic, the physical allergy. I don't have a big book in front of me, but I will tell you that if you're a Superman fan, you know that the big book has kryptonite. It does. Kryptonite inside the big book is the first drink. That book is useless. It has no program of action once you start drinking. It has no program of action, no solution-based recovery, nothing. The book between the doctor's opinion and the Roman numerals up until like page 40 lets you know that you cannot take that first drink. Once you do, you are doomed. You know, and sometimes we talk about the steps as to why do we work the steps? Is it to become a perfect person? If it is, that sounds like a rough go. But once you've been sober a while, you learn that no, it's to keep the mental obsession away. It's so that the mental obsession doesn't get so bad that I convince myself, because not only do I believe that I have a mental obsession, but my mental obsession talks to me. One of the earliest messages my mental obsession sent me from ages like 12 to 23 is that I don't have the allergy. These people are talking about hocus pocus, kind of crazy nonsense you hear maybe in church, but the first drink doesn't get me drunk. I feel bad for people who get drunk on the first drink. Like, where does that come from? And I seem to only get arrested when I do shots. If I could just drink beer, I would be fine, you know? And, you know, it's so important as to follow the steps as they're laid out in the book to let somebody know your whole life story. To then go into steps 1, 2, 3, and 4 as quickly as you can. Because when you go into telling your life story and especially talking the first step with a sponsor, you can figure out usually if you're like Fred or Jim. You can understand, boy, do I have that wrong with me? And, you know, it took me a long time, but I finally found the things by thinking about, oh my God, I was so out of my mind, I didn't realize how different I was than other people. I'll give you an example. So it's Friday night. Somebody's picking me up to go to a party. My generation, you get picked up in a Nova, a Monte Carlo, a Cutlass, Camaro, IROC towards the end. So 4 or 5 people pick you up, and we're going to a party. And they say there's going to be 5 kegs there. And you know, teenagers exaggerate. They say 5, there's probably 2. They say 10, there's probably, you know, they exaggerate. But I finally realized that, you know, why was I so uneasy in those cars going to those parties? I didn't even know the word or the phrase panic attack at the time. But I know that's what happened to me in that car, because all the people in that car, they were content just going to the keg party. I was having a panic attack because, you see, I can be in your parents' backyard at 3 o'clock in the morning. I can be hammered out of my mind. I can be totally blacked out for 2 or 3 hours. But I assure you, if air goes through a keg hose, I have like bionic ears. I can hear it from like 100 yards away. I can look over and see the keg floating in the water and the ice, and that sound of air brings immediate terror to me. Because I can't be in your parents' backyard and run out of alcohol. It's not an option for someone like me. So when I go to the party, I like to find a reason to tell you to stop at 7-Eleven. Because I like to have a 6 of Michelob in my hand. And as I'm walking in your parents' backyard, I like to put it behind the bushes. Or I know, because I've puked in enough houses, you know, at parties, I know that usually next to every bathroom is a towel closet. And a towel closet is a good place to put a 6-pack of beer with a towel over it, because if you put it in the refrigerator, somebody will drink it. And you see, at 3 o'clock in the morning, when the keg is empty, you don't care if the 6-pack is warm. I just care that I need to keep drinking. So I started to figure things like that out about myself. I always talk about concerts. To me, one of the joys of living is definitely music, you know, and everybody gets to decide which music they love or what different types of music they love. For me, it's has been and always will be metal. It's never going to change. Is there other music that I like? Yes. But metal will always be my baby, for sure. You know, last November, I saw Metallica for like the 53rd time live sober, right? I just finally lived and finally saw Tool live, which was amazing. But, you know, now they have all these fancy metal detectors. But back then, they used to have the pat-down line. So there would be all these big security guards, and you would walk in, and they would pat you down. And they would take whatever contraband you had. And if it was too much, you didn't get let in. You got to enjoy Pink Floyd from the parking lot, which, you know, I don't know what the public safety strategy is there, but hanging out with the people who have all not been allowed in some place because they have contraband is a pretty good night out. But I realized by working with another man, wow, there really were things like alcohol has invaded my entire life. Now, just tell you a couple other things about, you know, getting to AA. You know, when you have 42 Irish Catholic first cousins, it's a revolving weekend door. Every weekend is a confirmation, a graduation, a christening, a first communion. Like, you're always at some aunt and uncle's house when you have 42 kids. And they all ended the same way, like a Cops episode. And you know what that looks like. You know what that looks like. What is the average Cops episode domestic look like? There's a man arguing with a woman on a front lawn with a baby being held by one of them who's in half daytime, half nighttime clothes, who should have been in bed hours ago. That's how every one of my, whether it was my dad or one of my uncles and one of my aunts, that's how they ended. And I tell you that because that's the other part of this baffling thing that we suffer from. If alcoholic math is 2 plus 2 equals 4, based on what I witnessed with my own eyes growing up, I should have never drank. Based on what I personally witnessed with my own eyes around alcohol, I should have been, my brain should have told me, just don't drink. It just brings nothing but a horror show. And, you know, I can't tell you really what my first drink was. I can tell you that my dad had a great influence over me. Like my dad did not measure trips in miles. He measured them in tall boys. Like, how many tall boys is it to Yankee Stadium for a daytime game, right? Now, I'm not making light of drinking and driving because it is horrible and shouldn't happen. I'm just reporting where I come from. If I wanted to spend time hanging up with my dad, I had to be in a bar. That bar might be an Irish bar. It might be a Knights of Columbus Hall. It might be an American Legion Hall. It might be a VFW. But if I'm going to spend time with him, it's in a bar. So by the time I was 10 years old, I loved bars. I knew that an upside-down shot glass meant you had a drink coming. I knew that if a man bought a drink and put money on the bar, that the bartender made change and you left it there. You didn't put it in your pocket. The bartender would take change for the next drink. I knew every game of darts and every game of pool. I knew how to play foosball expertly by the age of 12. I knew what a Super Bowl box was. I knew what points on a game were. I knew all those things long before I would start my own bar career. I knew that my dad gave me certain advice growing up, and the one thing I would tell you about that advice is don't run out to Barnes & Noble tonight looking for my dad's expert book on raising a family. Now, I love my dad to death and buried him with as much dignity and respect as I could give. But, I mean, he told me and my brothers at a young age, like, there are two types of men in the world. Don't become one of those others. And when he said one of those others, he was picking on people that, like, come home from work. That would get you to sell out your man card in my dad's eyes. Like, you just came directly home from work. Or you volunteered for Little League or the Boy Scouts. Like, sold out on life. Turned in your man card. And violence was always the answer to any problem. And I'm not going to get into any graphic violence stories, but just have to be honest about reporting that. That violence was always the answer. You know, I got my ass kicked bad in elementary school one time. Really bad. Before my parents lived in different houses. When I got home, my mom was upset and said that she would take me to school the next morning and she would have the principal bring in the parents of the other boys that were involved. My dad came home like 8 hours later. He was not in for the going to the principal plan. He told me, we're going to forget about it. That's what we do. We let it go until they forget about it. Then we'll go after them. And if you get your ass kicked that time, then you let it go even longer. And you go after them with something. But he was not, like, very matter of a fact about those things. He didn't brag. It was just his code. A problem that's been in my life, you know, AA is a strange place. Odd probably is the best description. Number one, it's basically free. It's self-supporting, but it's free. But yet, most people I know have paid more to come to AA than anything else in their life. Maybe not money, but they've paid the biggest prices possible to come here. And, you know, when you tell your story, whether it's 8 people or 80 people, especially when you newly get sober, it's easy to talk about the things that sound cool. Beating up bouncers, fighting with cops. But, you know, once you're around here a while and once you get really familiar with Fred and Jim, those things have nothing to do with being an alcoholic. You start to realize, especially if you read some of Bill W.'s old writings, everybody who gets drunk fights with cops. It's what drunk people do. They just do. Drunk people do stupid things. You know? I used to love to be able to say, you know what? I jumped off a 5th floor balcony into a pool at a hotel. Well, guess what? Drunk people do that. That's not a requirement for being an alcoholic. That's just what drunk people do. You know, some people will say their worst day sober is better than their best day drinking. That is absolutely not my story. I think they get it from the page in the big book that says, I wouldn't trade the life I have today for the life of yesteryear. But I'll be honest. Checking into a maximum custody correctional facility at 24 years old and 5 months sober, that day was not better than the first day of spring break Fort Lauderdale 1988. Like, I know which day was better. Spring break was so much better. It's just people like me, we have to recreate spring break like every day. Like, I don't know how to leave the party and go back to the regular world. It still blows my mind how people pull this off. But one of the things I used to never talk about, and it affected my sobriety, because brains will kill you in AA. Brains will kill you. Because the other group of people that I sometimes insult are social workers, so let me get that disclaimer out of the way. If you are a social worker, I have the greatest respect in the world for what you do. It's a career that the world cannot do without. But you're looking at someone who is 56 years old, and I've still never been to a meeting with a social worker where I got good news, ever. Like, if I'm in a meeting and there's a social worker in the meeting, there's a good chance I'm going to about to hear something I really don't like. And one of those earliest meetings that I went to was with a social worker, my principal, my teacher, and my mother. And I was accused of cheating on a test. I did not cheat on that test, but I was accused of cheating. When my mother asked the teacher why she thought I cheated, her answer was not that I had an answer on my hand or a cheat sheet in my pocket or that I leaned over to look at somebody else's paper. She just said that no one that behaves the way your son does on the way to school or behaves the way he does in the classroom or behaves the way he does in the cafeteria or behaves the way he does on the schoolyard could possibly do that good on that test. Not possible. And I say this, you know I hear people, they were the last kid picked on the football team, the last kid picked on the kickball team or whatever, and I get it. I'm sure trauma comes along with that. I'm not here to dismay that. That was not my story. I was always a decent athlete, not the best, but decent. But I did know something I was the best at when I was in sixth grade. I knew it for sure. It was a self-discovery. I knew that everything that I read, I remembered. Like word for word. Everything. I knew that everything a teacher wrote on a chalkboard, I remembered. I could even picture where they wrote it on the chalkboard and what section of the chalkboard and how many inches down from the top. I also knew that I could do complicated math in my head and very complicated math on a small piece of paper. Like that I knew. And the reason I tell you that is not because I'm bragging, is because that destroyed me. You fuel that with my alcoholism, and I'm an unstoppable maniac. Because if there's one thing that I've been an expert at my whole life, is making the worst decisions possible when it comes to my own life. Like, I can sit down and give you advice, but in the area of self-advising, forget it. Now, when I went to junior high, I was not dressed like I am today. And hopefully I won't be buying too many suits that more. I wore black engineer boots every day, Levi dungarees, heavy metal concert shirt. I had a Levi dungaree jacket with an Ozzy Osbourne Diary of a Madman painting on the back of it. And I put a pack of Marlboro Red cigarettes down the front of my pants. That's how I went to school every day. And I don't know if you've ever been to accelerated math or gifted math. There's not a lot of other Ozzy Osbourne oil paintings. And actually, you know what the people there look like? Imagine when you go to your first, like, Joe and Charlie big book study, it's those people. They come prepared for class. They have highlighters and erasers and study guides and a dictionary, and they can't wait to start learning. Accelerated math, very little difference from a big book study. But I wound up getting kicked out of all those classes. I wound up being put in the resource room where they put all the bad kids, where you don't get to change class anymore. And, you know, I really want to take, you know, I have 60 minutes. I'm aware of how many minutes I have left from when we started. AA service is so important. And I'm not talking about being a trustee or a delegate or anything. I'm talking about any service for fun and for free for Alcoholics Anonymous. See, because I was 14 years old and had a PINS petition filed against me. That stands for a person in need of supervision. My school district filed one with the juvenile court. I was there, again a social worker, and I'm dating myself now. I'm a 70s, early 80s product growing up. The judge gave me a choice. Now, I don't know who told that judge about AA. I don't know if it was the day before. I don't know if it was the week before. I don't know if it was a couple of years before. But someone told that judge that he might have a young teenage male or female come into his courtroom who might suffer from alcoholism. Now, thank God, because we have lots of lunatics in AA who tell teenagers they're too young to be an alcoholic, which is insanity. Insanity. I have a professional license in 21 states. I have a cut-and-paste section of my laptop and my hard drive backed up for those questions. And if you're like me, you know those questions. Have you ever? Yes. No. Then right below it in parentheses, if you checked yes, please attach a narrative description of what happened in that situation. I know what my fingerprint report looks like. I know the nice woman in the state of Georgia at the insurance department who interviewed me, because I get the same letter back all the time. Every once in a while I need one of those licenses in another state, and I get the same letter. There's anomalies with your fingerprint report. There's no anomalies, by the way. It's true. It's actually 100% factually accurate. It's really good for a blackout drinker. It tells you where you were, what other people said you did, what you were willing to admit you did, and what you agreed to do as a result to pay back society. It's great for a blackout drinker. But that judge gave me a choice. Now, at 14 years old, it's important to tell you I had not been institutionalized yet. Today, I am very institutionalized. At 14 years old, that judge said, well, you seem to be having a lot of trouble at home and a ton of trouble at school and a ton of trouble with the police. So you can live in the juvenile department of corrections housing with a fence outside, and you can actually go to school in the same building. He said, or you can comply with this contract I'm going to make between you and your mother. And so my mother took that contract home and put it on a magnet on the refrigerator. And so that contract said I wouldn't smoke in the house. I'd take the garbage out on Tuesdays and Thursday nights. The judge was smart. It said not only would I go to school, but I would go to class when I went to school. Right? Like, he was smart enough to separate the two. And it said I would attend meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, the reason I made that choice at the time, I was not afraid to go to the Department of Corrections. I was afraid that I wouldn't be able to drink. See, by 14 years old, this might not be somebody else's story, but you see, but by the time I was in ninth grade, the only thing I thought about on a Monday morning is, where are we drinking Friday night? By the time I was in 10th grade, the only thing I thought on a Monday morning was, I can't make it to Friday night. I'm not like everybody else. Friday night might as well be next year. I'm not going to make it. And by the time I was in 11th and 12th grade, I rarely went to school on time on a Monday morning. Today, my life has turned 180 degrees. Today, I know that I can get hammered and drunk in any prison, basically in the world. definitely in the United States. But now I have a healthy fear. Now I think I'm not tough enough to go back in. But at least I know if I go back in, I can get drunk. Which leads me to this about corrections work in AA, which is, if there's people here who do it, I just want to thank you. The men and women who brought Alcoholics Anonymous to the correctional facility I was in, they didn't bring any special brand of AA. They didn't bring AA Light. They didn't bring AA without a third and a fifth tradition. They brought good old-fashioned, big book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am, you know, so grateful for that, because I hear people give opinions about what it's like to be a prisoner or an inmate, which I just came back, and I'll say in honor, I just a couple of weeks ago went to Tom I's funeral. And, you know, Tom, he's the first convicted felon in the United States to become the warden of a maximum custody penitentiary. So while I know that there seems to be a group of people that tell me that I'm offended to be called an inmate, I would let you know that I'm proudly an inmate. I've proudly been an inmate in a couple of correctional facilities. I did not go there because I'm alcoholic. I went there because I made some very bad decisions, and I don't blame those decisions on my drinking. Alcoholics Anonymous does not bring meetings and recovery into correctional facilities to stop crime. It doesn't go in there to transform people from criminal to good person. It goes in there for the same reason we have Alcoholics Anonymous meetings on the outside. To let some alcoholic know that they do not have to drink again. That we have a program of recovery. You know, as a result of those things that I talked about, my reading ability and my math, I just didn't go to class. I read things once and took tests. I thought I was smarter than everybody else. You know, there's a guy who's important in my story. I didn't like him. So if you're new, I just want to throw some out, some suggestions, one in particular. It's bad news. If you've been in and out of AA for a while, when you finally decide it's time to get sober, I hate to break this to you, but you are going to have to talk to the people you hate in AA. That's just a fact of life. Same people I hated. The active, over-the-top, passionate, no other thing in their life, I thought, but Alcoholics Anonymous. Some crazy kind of looking, religious, beaver, cleaver, Brady Bunch, milquetoast life with no fun and no heavy metal and no concerts. But my bad news is those are the people who are going to save your life. The guy who saved my life, he pulled me outside a meeting one time, and the first thing he told me that infuriated me was he said, I thought you said your license was suspended last week. I said, my license is suspended. He said, but you drove to the meeting tonight. I said, I know, I needed to go to a meeting. Of course I did. And he is like, we don't do that here. And I was like, you don't do what here? He's like, no, We believe that part of getting sober and becoming a recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous is like conforming to society's norms. Like the stop sign, it doesn't say except for Billy. The speed limit sign, it doesn't say except for Billy. Like there's no exceptions out there. And the next thing he told me, which I should have taken as a warning, was he said, Billy, you might be a pretty nice kid, but unfortunately, you're probably too cool to get sober. See, I say that because when I see a young kid in AA today, and I feel like I'm looking in a mirror, like when you've been too cool to get sober, you can recognize it from a mile away. You can see it from across the room. Never on time, except for sober softball, but never for a meeting. You know, always smoking cigarettes outside while the preamble's still being read. No service commitment. You know, I'll pass on some words I heard from a great judge, a great friend of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new and somebody's asking you to get a paper signed, that's fine, and you should listen to them, but it's useless. The amount of meetings you go to has nothing to do with getting sober. What is much more helpful is having a home group and a sponsor and a service commitment at that home group? And what step are you currently working on with your sponsor? That will blow away hundreds of meetings any day of the week. In that correctional facility, a miracle happened, and I was still an atheist, but I'm not an atheist anymore. But I was, and I got transferred to minimum security. And, you know, my story is just my story. It's not a good psychiatric report about my own mental health, but it's the truth. I do better in maximum custody than I do in minimum. I'm better with one or two cellmates, a small little day area with a TV, limited amount of time to shoot hoops or walk outside, but limited interaction with other human beings while I'm locked up and not drinking. Minimum, I struggle in. Like 100 guys in a room half the size of this on bunk beds, where I have to tie my sneakers to my bunk bed in case anyone steals them in the middle of the night. My temper and my temperament are not meant for that kind of inner social action so in my face every day. But there was really good AA. Really good AA. And I'm dating myself now, which I hate to do, but it's just the facts. I had a Walkman in minimum custody. If you don't know what a Walkman is, it was a small rectangular box that you could put a cassette in and play music, that headphones was actually attached by a wire. The number one songs at the time, I mean, my first love is heavy metal. My second love is really early 90s hip-hop. But, you know, the number one songs at the time were like You Can't Touch This and Hammer Time, and I could go on and on. But the outside correctional sponsors were allowed to bring us tapes in. And one day I picked up a tape, and it said Tom I, Aberdeen, North Carolina. And I listened to that tape, and I wore it out because I needed hope so bad. I just had my own horrible car accident with my own horrible consequences. I just knew that possibly my life could never get better. And then I hear a man who's 30 years sober at the time. He died 65 years and 7 months sober a couple of weeks ago. I hear a man who's 30 years sober who's a warden of a maximum custody penitentiary, who killed two people drinking and driving when he was 23 years old. You know, when I got out of that correctional facility and I was active in AA right away, but I got sent to a Joe and Charlie Big Book workshop. Now, you know, I already talked about those people, but you know that when you're new and you have nothing else to do but go to AA, you get to know every AA lunatic in every group. Like, there's always three or four over-the-top lunatics. And when you go to a Joe and Charlie Big Book workshop, it's like a reunion of AA lunatics for 100 miles. Like, AA, every AA lunatic for 100 miles is in the lobby of that hotel with their highlighters and their dictionary and their inventory sheets and their resentments and their four columns. But that weekend changed my life. That weekend changed my life when I found out about alcoholism. That weekend changed my life when I found out that when you get done with the third step, it says next. And that weekend changed my life by introducing me to a dictionary. Like, when you look up next in a dictionary, it's scary. It does not mean a couple of months. It does not mean, oh, you've been doing a lot of work, take a little break. It means next. Next. You know, and my advice to anybody would be, don't let the fourth step scare you out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not going to here to tell you how to work the steps. Just that you should. And just have a sponsor that you trust to take you through that process. Especially if you have some amends that maybe are going to be a little difficult, which most of us do. It's a very personal relationship. But I'm very grateful for the International Conference of Young People in AA that introduced me to service. That I put my hand up to be an alternate GSR in 1993. And 5 years ago, I put my hand up to vote for my replacement as the chair of the AA World Services Board and a Class B trustee. That gave me the opportunity to be a delegate when I was 32 and 33 years old. That I learned how to use Excel on a young people's committee before I even went back to college. You know, because we think we can't do anything. We think our lives are done. When that man handed me a community college application, my first reaction was, I won't finish till I'm 40. And he was like, well, either you'll be dead, or at least you'll be able to say you tried, even if you don't finish, but give it a shot. That's one undergraduate and two graduate degrees ago for someone who hates school and hates teachers, right? I mean, sobriety is amazing if you have a home group sponsor. And, you know, sobriety taught me how to use not even Word Perfect. I don't know if anybody remembers that. I learned how to use Word Perfect on a young people's committee. I learned how to negotiate contracts on a young people's committee. You know, I'm going to close with this. My mother died in January of 2000. She was in a hospice for a couple of weeks. One day I brought her, if you've ever dealt with somebody like that, they're hallucinating. Sometimes they're with you, sometimes they're not. It's almost like they're being pulled to the other side, then they're back. But one day Christmas Day actually, I brought me and my mother two large Dunkin' Donuts coffees, her wig, her perfume, her crazy Charlie perfume, her eye makeup, her crazy Irish music, a couple of Polaroids of her cat. It would be the last Christmas that she would ever see most of her family. And I got up there early that morning, and as I was, I might as well have been throwing back a tall boy sitting with a buddy. I'm in my mother's hospice bed with the bed propped up in the back, and we're drinking Dunkin' Donuts coffees. And she says to me, Billy, don't ever leave AA. She says, you know, AA gave me the ability to go get a quart of milk. And I thought to myself for a second that day, what the hell does getting a quart of milk have to do with AA? So I couldn't help myself, so I asked her, you know. I said, Mom, what do you mean by that? And she said, Billy, you don't know what it's like to be the mother or the father or the wife or the husband or the son or the daughter of an active alcoholic. You don't know what it's like dealing with that terror every day of your life. She goes, there was a time in my life when if I ran out of milk or sugar and it was at night, I wouldn't go to the store because the stores aren't crowded at night. And if the store is not crowded and I run into somebody I know, I have to talk to them. And if I have to talk to them, usually the first thing they want to ask me is, how are your children? Which is a question that I just can't bear to hear. She's like, but at some point in your sobriety, I couldn't wait to go out to the stores when they weren't crowded. I couldn't wait for someone to come up and ask me, how are your children? I couldn't wait to report the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon and what it has done for our family. And that's from a lady who would die 3 weeks later. The other thing I want to tell you is, you know, a lot of times we come here and all we do is we talk about ourselves, which is okay, but Alcoholics Anonymous is so much greater than any of us, especially myself. You know, a lot of people don't know this story, but in 1998, Time magazine knew that two things were going to happen in 2 years. They knew that the new century would come. And they knew that Time magazine would turn 80 years old. And as a result, they hired and commissioned a committee of the smartest historians in the world. Not AA archivists, nothing against any AA archivists here, but not AA archivists. Just the best academic historians alive in the world at the time. and they gave them an assignment. Start on January the 1st of 1900 and end on today and identify the 80 most important days. If you multiply 365 by 98, that's a lot of days. If you leave here today and feel like going to eBay or Google, just Google the 80 days that changed the world by Time Magazine and order yourself a copy. It sits on my night table at my house, on my coffee table. Because the smartest people in the world, if you go about 17 pages into that book, into the section on the 1930s, you land on June 10th, 1935, where it says, on this day, a broken stockbroker from New York met a broken surgeon from Akron, and from that meeting led to the birth of the Worldwide Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that has saved millions of lives and has shared their solution with people who have other problems. The last thing I'm going to tell you about AA, and not myself, is about my friend Jay, who I never met, but he's definitely one of my all-time AA heroes. All time. Maybe greatest, depending on the day. Since I'm a, you know, I used to be an atheist, Jimmy B. from The Vicious Cycle is definitely one of my heroes. But Jay, who I never met, is one of my heroes. And in 1983, Jay was a young U.S. Marine who was sober. And you know, if you're new and sober, if you're new in service and you're a GSR or anything, and sometimes there's an old timer in your group who says, that service is all politics. Or, you know, money doesn't matter or all this stuff. Don't listen to them. Remember Jay's story. Because Jay got sent to a place called Beirut, Lebanon, when it was not very friendly. And Jay wrote the General Service Office in June of 1983. And he said that he was a young Marine with no literature who was struggling, and he needed some literature. And so they returned literature to him through the U.S. military mail. Jay got his literature. Jay wrote back a month later. He said, please send me more literature. Thank you so much. They sent him more literature. A month later, Jay wrote back, and he actually used, if you read Jay's letters in the archives, he's using like Bill's language out of the big book. He wrote back and he said, I have good news to report. I've started a group here called the Peacekeepers Group. We have local civilians and men and women in the military, and we have meetings in between the shellings and the shooting. And my problem is, Jay said, now, I really need more literature. So the office sent him a box of literature through the military mail. And this went on for a little while. And then the office didn't hear from Jay for a couple of months. Couple of months, no letter from Jay. And then in December of 1983, they got a letter from another member of that group, a local who lived in Lebanon. And that member wrote the office and wrote the woman at the office he was writing with and said that she had the heartbreaking job of letting her know that the young man, young AA member, young Marine Jay, who she'd been writing with, had been killed in the barracks blast of October 1983, where over 275 U.S. personnel were killed. But she wanted the woman at the office to know that the group was still going. When you leave here today, if you Google AA in Lebanon, you'll see that on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturday nights at 8:30, there's a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because a young man needed literature and wrote a letter. And because home groups and other people put money in baskets and make contributions to the General Service Board, there was an office that could receive that letter, that could write a letter back, that could put literature. Most people don't know this, but 80% of the countries that have Alcoholics Anonymous in them, you can trace AA member number one back to a woman or man who served in the Canadian or United States Armed Forces, that they were stationed there and they brought the message there. So I never met Jay. I know he died a hero for a lot of other reasons. But for me, he's the ultimate hero in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was just a young kid, a young Marine, dying of alcoholism like me, who wanted to stay sober and wanted a book. and somebody sent them one book, like they did after the Saturday Evening Post article, sent them one book halfway around the world, and as a result of that, there's Alcoholics Anonymous in that country. Thank you very much for having me.